ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Prices shift, petrol jumps, shares fall. A company cuts jobs, and suddenly the business story is everyone's story.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. From Monday to Thursday on ABC Business Daily, we break down the biggest stories in business, finance, and the economy, and why they matter.
Then on Fridays, I'll go deeper on That's Business, with the people making decisions, taking risks, and shaping where the economy goes next.
Find it all in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
A historic win that came with a warning shot. One Nation is coming for your seat next. The Marna Party wiped the floor at the Farah by-election, claiming close to 40% of the primary vote and splitting the coalition support in half. It's the first time the seat has left coalition hands in 77 years and marks the first time One Nation has won a federal lower house seat. As party leader Pauline Hanson and new recruit Barnaby Joyce earmark the lower house seats they're targeting next, the Liberal and Nationals aren't completely ruling out a coalition with One Nation in the future, although that depends on who you ask. So does this disruption officially herald the death of two-party politics in Australia, and is it recasting conservative politics as we know it? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Jacob Greber.
And Jacob, it's budget week. In fact, tomorrow is the federal budget, one of the most significant federal budgets I think we will see for many years. The government's told us that, but I also reckon it's quite clear now that that's not just spin. But the Farah by-election results, so the seat of Farah vacated by Susan Lee, who was the Liberal leader until she was rolled, of course, about 3 months ago. She vacates the seat and it opens up the most intense fight of disrupted politics that I've seen. One Nation's David Farley claims the seat with 40% of the primary vote, which in our world of voting at the moment where the major parties are is really significant. Like a primary vote of that high is a big deal. And the coalition's vote, particularly the Liberal vote, has completely collapsed in that seat. What does it mean? It's seismic, isn't it, Jacob? It's not over-egging it, is it, to say that this is genuinely a big deal?
Absolutely. You've got a party that has never, ever won a lower house seat. Pauline Hanson's been in politics for 30 years. She got into Parliament as a Liberal. She'd fallen out with the Liberal mm-hmm. Party, but she was on the ballot as a Liberal. She lost that seat. Then later, she's made her way into the Senate. She's been thrown out of the Senate. She only got into the Senate in her current Senate position. She didn't make a full quota. She needed preferences from coalition tickets to get up. She has now pulled off this extraordinary prize of getting this lower house seat. It's a massive shakeup, particularly as you were saying on the coalition side of the ledger. Mm. The interesting thing, I guess, Farah has remained a conservative seat, as it has always been. It's just that the brand name at the top of the ticket has changed. And that's part of this revolution on the right-hand side of politics. But I think, and we can talk about it, there's plenty of lessons, things for the government to be worried about. Labor was not in that election, but I'd be surprised if they would have made 5%, quite frankly, if they had in terms of primary. It seems, talking to people down on the ground there and just looking at the raw numbers, people were grumpy and they were out to give the incumbents and the major institutional parties are thumping. And that's what they did.
That is what they did.
And unfortunately, from the point of view of the Liberal Party, they were the most institutional big party on the ballot. There was nowhere else, you know, there was no one else who was going to get flogged more than the Liberal Party, and they copped it.
They copped it big time. So here we have a genuine huge wrecking ball for the coalition in the form of a party that is basically trying to take their territory and then some, right? Because they're ambitious for other parts of the country too, not just Liberal seats or national seats. What I think is interesting about this by-election is that it comes close to 3 months after Angus Taylor became opposition leader. Angus Taylor's entire project, Operation Angus, was about stopping the bleeding to One Nation. And yet 3 months later, Farah happens and it's a huge repudiation. Now, on the night, some of the analysis that Angus Taylor himself provided was that it was after two breakups with the Nationals. I saw that as a pretty significant drive-by to Susan Lee, perhaps the Nationals too, but I felt like it was more Susan Lee, i.e., you know, that kind of muddied the waters. But he's had almost 3 months to get out there and say, it's not a small amount of time, it's not short. I don't think 3 months, like that's long enough for the voters of Farah to know that a new conservative guy is now in charge, if that's what allegedly they wanted. But they didn't choose that. They chose disruption. They chose a party that was right-wing but not institutional. And I think that's fascinating, don't you? Because it shows that is Angus Taylor really the solution to the current problem they have?
I think I'm not sure where I fall on that one, on that issue. Angus Taylor has not lit the world up since he's become leader. He's incredibly sort of low key, low fire, I guess you'd say, as the YPs might say. YPs are young people. He's not sort of lighting the place up. But I also just think in the specific instance of Farah, I'm not sure many Liberal leaders would have been able to turn that mood. I mean, I was down there in February when that by-election first got going, and it was poisonous. It was also poisonous against the former member in some quarters. There were Liberals coming up to me saying, I'm sick of this party. There were Nats saying, I'm voting for One Nation. I've been a lifelong Nationals and Coalition voter. So I think the mood for upturning the apple cart was already very, very strong. I'm not sure any leader could have reversed that. People's minds were made up.
Excellent
they were going
point.
To send a rocket.
Excellent point, and perhaps not. Mm. But when you're the leader, you have to take responsibility.
Sure,
part of the gig. It's why many of us would not want the gig.
I think there's also other things to unpack here. What on earth were the National Party doing in that race? They've always got this thing where once a seat opens up, you have a three-cornered contest. And the argument from the National Party for why they took on what was still the coalition vote, what was left of it, was still more in favour of the Liberals. And we saw that on the night with the primary. The Nationals, their job in these three-corner contests has always been internally, the argument goes like this, PK. We need to run in this three-corner contest because we're the ones who can counter One Nation. We're the ones who can give voters somewhere to go other than One Nation. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? That didn't work at all in Farah. In fact, all the Nationals probably did was cannibalise some of the Liberal Party vote. So there needs to probably be a bit of a reckoning there inside the coalition. What on earth were you thinking when you had this threat, big, big threat from a One Nation? Why did you split your resources, your attention into a traditional three-corner contest? So that's a big question. I mean, frankly, if you extrapolated this to a national vote at a federal election, oh boy. You could have a scenario where there's really only one National left in the Senate at this rate.
So which brings
you can't do that because that's too reductive.
But, it is because it's a by-election, and so by-elections are always different. People are smart. Those voters were smart. They know what they're doing. They know that they're not changing a government, for instance, that it's just a by-election. They're sending a message. So then it goes to the question of, was this just a protest vote? Well, you know, of course, there's an element of protest, but I don't think so. I think people are making rational decisions about the way they're feeling about the country and their material conditions. They don't like the Liberal National parties. But the point you made about Labor is a really good one. If you look at the Labor vote at the last, just a year ago, at the last election in Farah, that vote you would think, right, you know, if you're expressing a view which is Labour-ish, that perhaps more of it should have gone to Millthorpe, the independent candidate. Now, some of it clearly did, but not all of it. In fact, some of it went to One Nation.
It's the only conclusion you can draw from the way those numbers
you look
developed.
At how it's sprayed, as they say, where sprayed. It's gone, that number. And so the hard heads in the Labour Party are worried about it. They are watching it. And that brings me to, which we'll talk about now, what the budget might look like, because this is a budget being constructed at a time where the government has read the mood of the nation. They know that the One Nation vote isn't just about the right wing of politics, although it is primarily still, let's be fair, that's primarily what it's doing. But it's also about grievance, about the sort of state of the country, that collective feeling of being getting poorer and poorer, which the RBA governor confirmed to us. She said it. You're feeling poorer because you are poorer. Like, it's a fact. People's conditions have been going backwards because of inflation. It's eating at our standard of living, right? And that's just uncontestable. The One Nation issue, I don't think, is a flash in the pan. I'm saying it. I don't think it's a flash in the pan. That's not to say that things can't go wrong for One Nation. Candidate selection, controversies, you know, the theory that David Farley won't stay in for long. Well, I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's one theory that's been put to Pauline Hanson. All of that could happen. And all of that will be annoying for One Nation and their ability to keep growing. But man, they've got the wind in their sails, don't they?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. And they're now able to raise money. The story of their success opens all these other seats up now to be potential gettable places for One Nation to win lower house seats. Barnaby Joyce saying this morning, we want to go for government. Now, he doesn't mean he doesn't think he can win enough seats to form a majority in the parliament. What he's saying is that One Nation can now win enough seats at the next election potentially to be the kingmaker of a conservative government if the rest of the conservative side of politics in any shape and form gets its act together. So big if there, but they've got some, they've got the stars in their eyes now by the looks of it in terms of the way they're speaking and what's possible.
And they are a more professional outfit than they used to be. You know, you just look at that campaign rally, the event itself, the branding around them, the infrastructure around them is improving. You can see it.
And you can also see it in the body language of some of the conservative voices. People you would have thought would never, ever countenance doing any kind of a deal or any kind of an arrangement with One Nation. People like Tim Wilson saying...
Although he's walked that back. Okay, say what he said, because he's kind of walked it back a bit today.
Okay, well, I'm not up to speed on what he's walked it back, but I'm going off what he first said, which is almost a resignation that, look, if that is how the Australian public is voting, I think he might have been reacting here in the heat of the outcome, so that's probably the most honest response. He's essentially saying, look, we'll have to deal with the world that we face after the next election. And if One Nation is a block in the parliament, do we just say, no, we shan't do deals with them,
and we'll be banished to the back bench? And that's the statement of the bleeding obvious.
I mean, it might be the wrong message to send to prospective Liberal voters, because you're legitimising One Nation as an alternative. You still get a Conservative government, but you know what? You can still vote for One Nation. It's probably not the message he meant to send. But I think there was a bit of radical honesty about...
Yeah.
This is the reworking, the reshaping of the political right in this country.
And then it's the lesson. So the political right thinking, well, the lesson is that we have to, be clearer about, what was that line from Angus Taylor on the night? I remember it. We've been a party of convenience, not conviction. You know, this, we've got to stop the convenience and be conviction politicians. Now, I agree with the sentiment that conviction is clearly what people are looking for. But is the same conviction, the same song sheet as One Nation going to suddenly return the Liberal Party to its former glory? I don't reckon. I mean, they've just literally elected a dude that they think they can do that. Why would they go? Why? Like, just go to the people who said it maybe first and clearer. And then there's the problem
this
of who
is
their base.
This is the idea if you're going for a One Nation light type approach.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I don't know why you need to vote for them then. Like, why would? Because you can vote for One Nation.
That's right. The full sugar Coke or the one with the diet.
I don't know. And like, you know, all tastes are lovely. Depends what's offered to you, right, at that point, and you know where you can get your bargains. I just think that the problem for them is so much more deep rooted. They lost their heartland in the cities. They are now losing their heartland in the regions. What's left then? Where's
the
pathway?
Suburbs, the western suburbs, and you can see One Nation already beating a big pipe band coming through over the ridge, over the hill into Western Sydney. seats like Melissa McIntosh's, very, very concerning for the Liberal Party. And there are others up and down the coast. Now, lots can go wrong between now and the next election, which is probably 2 years away.
Yeah, that's right.
So you've always got to put that caveat over the top of this stuff. But it's all very, very conceivable this morning when you look back on that result on Saturday.
That result on Saturday has left so many Liberals just smashed, I've got to say. Like, one Liberal said to me, "It's funny, you said your phone was blowing up." I said that on air on Saturday night. Mine was deathly quiet. And that speaks volumes too, because people are like, what has just happened to us? Now, I think the story is mixed. There's a lot of anger and oversharing, and then quietness. It depends who you're talking to and what their agenda is. There are people who have grievance about the whole transaction to Angus Taylor, so there is some grievance from some people about that. And then others who think their problems are much more deep-rooted and they haven't dealt with them properly, more, you know, moderates who are a bit worried. But the base question is a big one. Who is their base now?
Well, I mean, think of it this way. Susan Lee at the last election, I think her primary was 44. It might need to be fact-checked on that. Mm. The point was it was just below 50, which is the first time that had ever happened. So there was a bit of writing on the wall there. And Michelle Millthorpe was able to capture some of the anti-Lee vote, or people who are disappointed in Lee looking for an alternative. But I think also Millthorpe's sort of campaign a year ago was a little different. She was much more scrutinised this time around, so people got a close look at her. Mm. And I suspect there might have been people who voted One Nation on Saturday who had voted for Millthorpe a year ago because they were sick of Lee, but were already really ultimately conservative voters.
Yeah, so they were an anti-establishment vote.
Yeah, yeah. And now you have One Nation's Farley, David Farley. You said 40%? Well, that's awfully close to what Susan Lee got. Those two numbers, what Lee got a year ago and what David Farley got now under One Nation, that number being almost the same in terms of primary, that's your earthquake right there.
What will be interesting to see now is further defections. This is often what happens in these scenarios, and we saw that in the UK where we saw Tories defecting to Reform UK. And that brings me to the UK local elections, which delivered an absolute smashing of UK Labour. And also just generally Reform genuinely delivering results there. The populist trend is an international one. We were never immune, and now it's come here, but it's happening there in real time as well. And that's putting pressure there on Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister. Now here, as we were saying, not the same pressure, I don't think, on Albanese, but we are entering budget week. Tomorrow the federal budget is delivered by Jim Chalmers. Bit more detail out today about the negative gearing capital gains tax changes. It seems to me that we have a government that is throwing all the cards up in the air at the moment and being bolder and taking risks. Breaking promises is a very risky strategy in my view, because they can feel that in the community there's a view, whether it's from the left or the right or some hybrid, because I think there's a lot more people who are left and right at once, and that the old paradigm is being smashed more and more. They want big change. Now, I'm sure not all the people in Farrer want the sort of change of negative gearing and capital gains, which is more of a left-leaning, at least traditionally, idea. But they are looking for big changes, things like the gas taxes, all of these big ideas. And so Labor's going there tomorrow night, right? Not on gas tax, just to be clear, but on some of the other things.
Well, it's interesting you brought up the gas tax, because I think there's acute sensitivity there about how they're getting walloped by some of this social media campaigning on the gas tax issue. And they've tried to manage that by bringing forward this reservation idea, which they did at the end of last week. I don't know that it neuters that, but that's what they're trying to do. The big question in my mind, and we'll know the answer in a little over 24 hours from when we're talking, PK, is: are the changes they're making, what are the purposes of them? Are they to make the tax system simpler, fairer, or raise more money? And I'm not sure yet where it lands in that matrix, that little triangle where you'd lean to on each of those three corners, because if it's about raising revenue, then you would have revenue that you can use for other things like income tax cuts or more spending on welfare programs, which is what Labor says it wants to do with, for instance, childcare. Is it about simplifying the tax system? I don't know that the portents are particularly good on that front. We're talking about switching CGT from a flat 50% discount to some sort of indexation system that existed back in the 90s. That all sounds to me like the only winners will be accountants. They will love this change because it'll make a whole bunch of tax affairs that much more complicated. That's the third leg, and that's the second leg. And the third leg is, of course, does it make the tax system fairer? And that's what the government's rhetorically saying it's going to be about. But those three things all have to come together. And I think that's the unknown. We already know really probably most of what's in the budget. My mail is not a lot of rabbits left to be pulled out.
I heard that one before.
And we've all heard that one before. And I think the surprises are probably in the detail of those changes.
Yeah.
That's where the surprises will be.
So today our friend and colleague Phil Currie had a bit of a yarn in the Fin Review about the way that capital gains tax will be implemented, which I thought was interesting detail.
And a bit of a sort of delay in the way it's brought in.
A year delay in terms of, so it starts essentially where it stays on new properties, which I think is very wise, by the way, because you just want to give people any incentive to
invest
in new properties, because we have a supply problem. That's a fact, not contestable. And Labor still says that, that is a big issue. So that way you keep that going. So there's an incentive if you want to, if people are using negative gearing to minimise their taxable income, well, then they'll still invest in new housing potentially because they're like, oh, well, that's a good idea. And then, there's more incentive to make more houses. That's the economic explanation, right? But then the question of if negative gearing stops from budget night, they were worried about a sudden kind of how people respond to that. So really it's going to take about a year till it begins, right?
Well, I think the main design concern is if you do a rapid change in the incentives for investing in property, one of the things that's happened in, for instance, New Zealand, you ended up driving rents up very, very quickly. And that is definitely not what the government wants to happen. That will be a marker of failure, not success, if that's the outcome. So they'll need to be very mindful of that because it has happened in other jurisdictions.
Of course it happens.
And so that's one of the reasons why I think they're doing this 12-month.
So what that means too, though, is it doesn't mean that people rush to, get into negative gearing and then stay on the system, because you only can be on it for a year if you're new post-budget day.
And that goes to that sort of, apparently this is a dubious term, by the way, I've learnt this morning, comes from the Jim Crow era in America. But grandfathering was to do with who got the vote back then, post-Civil War. Anyway, that's for nerds to go and look up. But this question of very nerdy, we like a bit of that here. The question of grandfathering all these changes is really at the core as well of the political debate. We'll see. We've been told that a lot of these changes will not affect people whose arrangements currently benefit from them. If you're able to negative gear X number of properties, you won't be touched. Or if you currently,
Look, I understand. So vexed.
That's very, very tricky because
Because it's not as effective when you grandfather.
Right.
Like, you're not getting the results like the...
Well, terms of, say you want to raise more revenue under the new tax system, if everyone who's currently got those arrangements isn't affected, well, then it takes a long time for the government to see the revenue benefit. And by the way, it's also essentially pulling up the drawbridge for any younger voters now. Millennials and younger, the boomers and Xers got this quote-unquote tax lurk. You guys ain't getting it because we're about fairness. Well, that's going to be a tricky one to sell.
Yeah, because they're holding on to it. Equally, telling voters, you went to the last election and we told you we weren't going to touch negative gearing capital gains, and now we are, and you're not getting grandfathered. I mean, that's terrible politics, because you went to that election, right? And you voted Labor, let's just say, and some people would have, by the way, because you heard the Prime Minister say, no, I'm not going to touch that stuff. That's not my thing. It's not my jam.
I've said it 50 times.
Yeah? And you've made a decision to hold on to your properties or, you know, whatever. Like, and so all of your financial arrangements then get changed because you're not being grandfathered. Can understand that's very, very difficult and risky, but maybe not good risky politics for a government, don't you think?
Yeah, it's one of the big questions of the night. That's where the surprise will be in terms of what we get.
Now, tomorrow, Jacob, I'm bringing our beautiful listeners, and I know they're all very good looking and smart because I've seen some of them. They're very good looking, very smart.
The most good looking.
The most good looking, the most beautiful people. 2 episodes of the pod. Tom Crowley will join me for a regular episode to bring you pre-budget forecasts. There'll be, you know, a bit more in the papers and on the ABC website tomorrow morning. And then in the budget lockup, so I'm going to do my show outside of the lockup. Then I go into the lockup. I love telling people how the sausage is made and then read the budget papers like a very excited person that I am. And then Carrington Clark, who is the host of the ABC's Business Daily podcast, our sister pod or our brother pod, we get into a tiny booth and make a joint episode about what's in the budget that both feeds get. So it's like
for the price of one.
What do you think of that?
It's just more podcast.
It is.
Double the podcast.
But with the information.
Double the flavour.
So
double
things
the flavor.
Like the grandfathering question we will answer because we will have the budget papers in front of us and you'll also get our hot takes, which I'm sure people are like, oh, how do I even go to bed tonight without their hot takes? Well, you got these hot takes. I want to know what your budget nerdery looks like. Like when you get into the lockup, now I go in delayed. I still get in. I'm still locked for 2.5 hours, but you're doing the 5. What do you do first?
In terms of what I do is I usually skim read the speech.
Yes, me too. Okay.
The speech, because yep. I'm looking for the rhetorical
yes.
flourish. I'm looking for here is the story we want to tell the Australian
and
people.
And do you have a highlighter and what colour is it?
It's probably, depending on which one's in my drawer, I'd say probably yellow.
Okay. More
mine's often
pink.
Than yellow. Yours
I
is
always
pink.
Take a pink highlighter.
There we go. Mm. And then lots of little post-it notes.
Yeah. And then so you do little highlighting?
Yeah, little highlighting.
Okay.
And then I like going to this table. Particular table that will tell you what's changed since last year's budget and the MIEFO update just before Christmas. That tells you the story
the
and numbers. It's the table of truth. Mm. We'll call
I know
it the table.
Table. I know the table. My favourite is budget paper number 2. It's always been my favourite budget paper.
I also go to the very last section of the budget. There's a table that shows you the history of budgets. That one's always very, very important.
That's way nerdy.
No, that's probably stop 3. That's my third stop, bus stop of the budget tour.
Okay. Yeah. And then how about the propaganda?
Because that tells you how does this budget and the way it's changing the shape of the economy compare to previous budgets? Mm. You instantly then have a point of
reference. And who taught you – sorry, I think this is – I love a bit of budget chat. You know this. Who taught you to read a budget?
Look, it was many different economists. One of the privileges of being a journalist is you get access to some of the best brains, people who spend their entire lives thinking about these things. There's many, but the Chris Richardson's an obvious one. Saul Eslake's another one. Mm-hmm. There are former Treasury secretaries. There are former senior bureaucrats. I won't name them because they don't want to be named, but they're the kind of people that teach you how to read budgets.
So I got taught by George Megalogenis, who of course is quite well known, I think, in the community, author, journalist, when I was a baby journalist, and he really taught me a lot about how to read the budget. Because unless someone is actually showing you, you go here, this is the thing, like to find where they hide things.
They do change. Budgets do change and governments change the way they account for different things. And one of the classics here is the big increase in quote-unquote off-budget items. Mm. And that's quite a nice little trick where you reduce the amount of upfront spending by putting it into a quote-unquote investment that has to generate a return. That takes a bit of unpacking. And it's becoming very common.
Oh, I had a lot of fun talking to you today.
Got very nerdy there, didn't we?
Yeah, but I just think sometimes, especially the Politics Now audience, I know that people are really, I mean, some people actually read the budget themselves and will email me and say, you missed this. And okay, all right, you're smart of me. That's it for Politics Now today. If you have a question for us, send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au and we will try and make an episode to answer them. See you, Jacob.
Take care.